when I think about AI transformation, I think about the impact of people. I think that's where you really get into, you know, how much of this is about technology and how much is it about people and behavior change.
Welcome to Modern Business Operations, where we talk with leaders about how ops is adapting to our modern world.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Modern Business Operations. My name is Sagi. I'm the CEO and founder of Tonkin. And today I have the privilege to talk to Bob Pulver, the founder and principal of Elevate Your AIQ, a strategic advisory firm. I am very curious to hear more about this. This is like the call of the hour, if you will. But thank you first, Bob, to joining me today.
Thanks for having me, Sagi.
Awesome. Well, let's maybe start there, you know?
Yeah.
Give the background, the quick story of what you guys are doing too.
Sure. So my background is enterprise transformation. So I spent the first 25 years of my career at big enterprises, over two decades at IBM, and then a couple of years at NBC Universal in New York City. And the IBM tenure was not just significant, but it was varied. So I did a lot of jobs around supply chain transformation, operations, a little bit of strategy, a little bit of consulting, market intelligence. So I really got the breadth of a lot of what IBM, you know, had to offer and was bringing to market across different lines of business. I would say the role that I had the longest, which was, you know, very obviously influential in my path from there, was around innovation and the connection to emerging technologies, a lot of which came out of IBM research. So I basically partnered in this innovation lab that connected IBM's biggest clients to research, to not just think about what's available now, what's on the product roadmap out of our, you know, the software teams and hardware teams and things like that, but what's on the sort of H2 horizon? What are the things that I need to be thinking about as I do my strategic planning across business, technology, and talent? And how do I best, you know, sort of prepare for that? Even, you know, sort of teasing them with some opportunities to get a sneak peek at some, you know, patent pending work that IBM was doing, and form some unique partnerships where they would get essentially first mover advantage on some emerging tech. So in fact, IBM Watson was one of those areas. And so I literally had the mock Jeopardy studio in my office, and got to play and watch how Watson performed. You could see behind the scenes and how it was had to reach a certain threshold of confidence before it would buzz in, and all the underpinnings of that. So that really sort of piqued my interest about where things could go after seeing what I thought were some pretty advanced, you know, research projects and some pretty cool tech that other teams were building. And now to see this sort of public introduction of AI to everyone was very sort of influential to me. And the remaining years of my IBM tenure were either trying to sell Watson, use Watson, help people come up with new ideas of how to apply Watson, either for cost savings or revenue generation, you know, ideas and things like that. So, and then at NBC, it was, how do I take some of those concepts and try to take an organization who was not as advanced as IBM in terms of their technical maturity and their data maturity, and how to sort of help people open their aperture to how they could bring that into, you know, the media industry. And it's everything from automation through, obviously now we're talking about, you know, generative AI these days, but some of the fundamentals that I'm sure we'll get into, Sagi, is as people talk about, you know, AI strategy and where do I start or what use cases should I prioritize and things like that, some of those fundamentals still hold very much true in terms of the process reengineering and simplification you want to do before you do any automation, and then the decisions these days around build versus buy versus bot. And what do we take off people's plates? How do we streamline those workflows? How do we automate some of those workflows? And then where do we deploy, you know, AI agents and things like that? So I'm sure we'll get deep into the AI weeds in that regard, but that's sort of the general sort of trajectory of my career. So I'm not an enterprise anymore. Obviously, I went out on my own in early 2021, so about 4 or so years ago. And I've been more in the talent space. So sort of responsible and human-centric AI at the intersection of talent, transformation, and innovation, I guess, were some of the key sort of themes that I focus on now. So I work with software vendors and solution providers in the space we're building, either AI native or adding AI capabilities to some of their SaaS applications. But I'm also very concerned on the buy side for talent acquisition teams and, you know, HR teams more broadly, to make sure that their people are ready, that they have AI literacy and readiness, and they're embracing this. This is not a fad. This is not going away. And if you're having issues with it now, just know that it's only going to get smarter. Part of my job is to make sure it gets smarter, but also stays, you know, ethical and responsible.
Well, like we started, it's super timey, right, with everything. So your Watson days almost like made a comeback in a way, because I feel like there was a big hype of what can be and then kind of died down and came back. But I actually wanted to maybe start from slightly different angle and kind of attach to one word you said earlier in your career, in and around like transformation. And I feel like what's interesting about, well, two things actually crossed my mind. One is, it feels like the last transformation hasn't completed yet, and the next transformation comes up, right? So as when you advise, you know, I'm kind of curious how you think about that. And then the second thing is what you said, the last point around, this is not going away, this is here to stay. And how do you think this transformation wave might be different than the previous ones, whether, you know, it's the cloud, I'm focusing on enterprise, but like the cloud and the mobile and so on.
Yeah, I think that this comes up a lot. And some of the things I pay attention to now are like, how successful are companies when we talk about like an AI-led transformation, AI transformation, whatever sort of phrasing you want to use. But my whole career has been some form of transformation. So to your point, it never really ends. Like, you're always sort of evolving, right? And so sometimes it's in an iterative way. Sometimes it's focused on a particular part of a business. So in my mid-career at IBM, work around transformation was, for example, client process transformation, looking at transforming processes across different go-to-market channels, whether that was direct sales or through IBM's business partner, you know, ecosystem, and then web sales, right? So at the time it was selling over the web, and, you know, emailing outreach and all that stuff was kind of new, right? So those were like three channels, and we had to basically, you know, streamline a lot of the workflows and systems for that type of transformation. And so a lot of that was more about the process and then the infrastructure that sort of managed that and the data sharing that needed to take place even before, you know, cloud computing, I suppose. But then once cloud came, so I kind of went through the cloud transformation twice. I went through it with IBM because obviously they were a solution provider in that space. They were never at the time in the conversation with like AWS and Google and Microsoft, but they were like the fourth one. Or if you needed like private cloud, they were definitely, you know, a top choice. But then when I got to NBC, we actually did it again because they weren't as progressive and hadn't invested. So there was a whole exercise to go through, like a portfolio modernization and rationalization exercise, as well as the migration from maybe 15 or so data centers around the world into cloud. So I think part of the difference is this, the breadth of the transformation that we went through with some of those earlier transformations. I do think, when I think about AI transformation, I think about the impact of people. I think that's where you really get into, you know, how much of this is about technology and how much is it about people and behavior change, right? And so I don't love using the phrase change management, but I know a lot of people still use that quite a bit. So I guess I'll use it here just for the audience's sake. But it's really like, how are you communicating the value of why we're sort of disrupting, you know, the way we do things? How do you create both top-down and bottom-up support through a network of sort of change agents or catalysts or champions, however you want to describe them. But people who know enough and are close enough to the strategy for that line of business or their overall organization so that they can be the messengers and they can start to help to shift behavior. This is the way we're going to share information now. This is the way, not everyone's going to blog, but you should know that there's a lot of insight that you can gain from reading other people's blogs. Or executives want to find a new method of communication to talk to their teams. And so when you get to like social types of transformation is really where you've got to say who can be those sort of internal influencers to help this be more successful, because transformation is much bigger than like a technology implementation, no matter how big that technology implementation is. So I think like when we moved to the web and we started doing a lot of social collaboration through Facebook like platforms at IBM, we had IBM Connections. There's a whole suite of communities and forums and wikis and blogs and things like that. And so people were working out loud. So people would start to say, this is how I'm building this. This is what I'm doing. This is what I'm concerned about, those kinds of things. And so you really start to see that wave of crowdsourcing and the ability to aggregate the collective wisdom and the collective intelligence of a larger network. We started seeing, again, some toys from IBM Research came into play, where we were doing social network analysis and expertise discovery. And you really sort of broke down these sort of silos and other just sort of traditional barriers from knowledge dissemination across an organization. So when it comes to AI transformation, I think it's closest to that type of what we used to call social business transformation, just because it impacts every individual, at least from a knowledge worker standpoint. But you've also got to accept the fact, in IBM's case, there were people in manufacturing facilities and, technicians and other people who weren't, in front of a keyboard all day. And so AI has no one is spared. If you're a tradesman, you're a craftsman, and you're working with your hands and whatever, you may not feel the impact like day to day, but maybe there's AI handling customer service. Maybe there's AI booking appointments. Maybe there's other ways behind the scenes, operationally, where it's helping to improve efficiency, reduce the downtime between appointments and whatever it is. But in terms of like knowledge work, there's really no one that's spared. It's just a matter of how quickly, AI and automation come for the tasks that are currently on your plate, right? So that's why I feel that everyone needs to become AI literate and ready. And so part of that might be dictated by the speed and adoption rate that your organization, embraces and how quickly they want to invest in this capability. But there's really no escaping that from a survival standpoint, you have to find ways to make yourself more efficient, but also think about other ways where you can generate, more revenue, entering new markets, targeting different, buyers and different customer sets and things like that. So you've got to play defense, reducing costs, mitigating risk and things like that. But you also have to go on offense and say, what else, now that I know what AI and automation can do for me, what else could I do? And part of that is potentially unleashing and reusing the capacity that you're going to unlock by taking, 10, 20, 30 or more percent of the tasks off someone's plate. Well, the knee-jerk reaction might be, oh, look at all these people, I could now let go. But the better question is, what else could they be doing, right? And what else are they capable of?
This episode is brought to you by Tonkin. Tonkin is the operating system for business operations, providing businesses with the building blocks to orchestrate any process with no code or change management required. Contact us at tonkin.com to learn how you can build complex processes fast. Let me ask you a question. This is fascinating. I largely agree with everything you said. I like the way you described the difference between like a technology innovation or transform that leads to transformation versus a social ones that actually impact social. And I'm 100% aligned with you. Personally, I was part of that. I worked on projects around that same social feed and blogs within organization, all that stuff in my previous part of the career. But there's another aspect of it I'm curious to hear your thought. In between all of this, we had COVID. And COVID brought another transformation, which is the remote work, Zoom, you and me are doing it right now over, remote. And of course it required the cloud. It pushed wait, your business application needs to be in the cloud. Otherwise people can't work from home. You needed a Zoom. And they literally won the name of it because of that. The video conferencing had to become much better. But from a social perspective, it was immediate, right? It's like one day, it's not a must thing. You maybe do a conference call on voice. You go to the office. It's like the video thing wasn't like a thing you have to do. Yeah. Or knowing how to work from home was not something a lot of people did or knew how to do well. To a point where this is the new reality. That's just it, day and night almost.
Yeah.
How much do you think, and this is a big question today around whether it's hype or not. I don't think there's definitely the fringe people that think that, AI is nothing, right? But I think it's really fringe. I think the majority of people by now agree with everything you said, this is transformational. This will change everything. The question is though, how fast is still is this a hype where this is, like you said, existential, you have to do it right now? Or is this more of the mobile and the cloud, not from a tech, or actually the collaboration you mentioned? It's like people are still using email today,
yeah,
but they're also using everything else. And so where would you rank that for AI?
Yeah, I think AI is, I think it's as disruptive as any of those things. I mean, I do think the ubiquity of this type of communication, where it's sort of, I don't want to get people confused with terminology, but it's sort of multimodal in a sense, right? It's not just audio, right? Or audio and video, just like when you go into a ChatGPT or some of these other tools, you can have a text-based conversation, but you can also use your voice. And you can also have it create images, right? And there's other tools that let you create presentations and, videos and stuff like that. The COVID thing and being remote, all of a sudden everyone being remote was a really interesting phenomenon for me personally, having spent my years at the turn of the century at IBM. And we had all those things already. We were using them, right? Now, the bandwidth wasn't as good and the cloud wasn't fully formed, I suppose. But I mean, I remember in 1999, 2000, being in my little shoebox New York City apartment, being on conference calls talking about whether we're ready for deployment of SAP, instance or whatever the next release was. I was sort of spoiled, right? I had a lot of those toys and I was able to work remotely, 20 years before COVID. So to me, it was just I didn't know what I was getting all, in a frenzy for. But at the same time, my wife runs a small business and she still doesn't, it's 2025 and she still is not regularly on video calls, right? So I have to put things into perspective, and certainly that's the case of partners and clients and things like that. It was certainly very disruptive, and we've also, of course, seen the whiplash where everyone says, no, I think we're better off having everyone back in the office. Well, there's pros and cons to both. Ideally, you have flexible arrangements to accommodate people's needs, and in some cases, people moved based on the prior policy, and now you're kind of putting them in a very awkward position, an untenable position in some cases.
So when you think about the timeline, right? So that's actually a really good point, right? Early adopters of technology from both a company perspective and an individual perspective on a specific role, because you were, probably was in IT around the places where it is, the toys are more than just toys. It's like you're trying to live, right? I think that is the conversation that I find interesting right now, that the pace of the improvement in AI is very rapid, but the pace of people's ability to change does not, I don't want to use the same word, but it does not change because of how fast the, you know, the technology, like people are just takes time to kind of like, sometimes it takes like a decade for any technology to be the baseline, right? Yeah. You know, we saw it even in Google search, like it's not that old of a technology. It's actually still relatively, but it took like at least a decade, especially for older folks or folks that are not sort of like tech savvy, for them to become a default of like, let me just search Google versus like ask, you know, a person.
Yeah, I think it's interesting, like to your point, like COVID was like everyone was just sort of kicked out of the office, right? And there's just like, you, whatever the learning curve is, you better hyper accelerate it, right? Because like today you're in the office, tomorrow, you got to be set up and you're sort of forced to figure it out. And so, but even, you know, as I think about generative AI, which was really people's, the average person's first exposure to be able to interact directly with it, right? So the user interface, the UI is like, AI is the UI now, right? So I think that was a huge, you know, novelty. But I think as I look at the scope of all the ways in which people are thinking about their AI strategy and their AI readiness, and there's a lot of facets to it, and everyone's sort of moving forward at different speeds. So there's not such urgency as there was being thrust into essentially a new paradigm and a new environment that COVID sort of forced us into. However, at this point, you know, ChatGPT, you know, this November, ChatGPT will have been out for three years, right? So you could argue that people have had a couple years to start to get acclimated and play around with it. I mean, it's on your devices, or if it's not, it could easily be just by installing an app, and there's desktop apps, and there's, you know, all kinds of things that people can take advantage of. So I do think that depends on the organization's, you know, sort of policy and stance on how quickly they want to adopt, but they need to think about what's a sort of healthy, you know, rate of adoption, so that you don't have more backlash than you would want. You're gonna have some naysayers, right? You're gonna have some people that say, I don't think we're ready for this, because going back to what we talked about before, there's a lot of sort of fundamentals that need to be in place for you to just go to be all in on AI, right? Not to mention the fact that with the video conferencing, yes, you had to check some new settings. Maybe certain companies you had to use, you know, a VPN, and there's some other, you know, pieces that you had to have secured and locked down from a privacy and cybersecurity standpoint. But the AI thing, I think, is people were, especially, you know, in hindsight, people have been appropriately, you know, cautious about jumping in, because there's a lot of concerns, because, you know, putting on my responsible AI hat for a minute, there's a lot of black box kind of solutions. Like, you don't even know how it's coming up with the information that it's feeding you. And if you don't have the domain knowledge to know when to challenge it, right? If you're not thinking critically about the output that it's giving you, then you could get yourself into some trouble, right? And we've seen a lot of headlines in that regard. So I think in this case, the risks are a lot higher. And there's also a lot of conflicting information between, you know, adoption rates with inside companies and the success that they're having, throwing up these sort of vanity metrics about how productive they're being or how many people they let go or whatever. But if you look at like research papers and people doing, you know, deep research and thoroughly testing these models, people are right to be concerned. So I don't want people to, I'm not such a AI advocate that I want you to go in, you know, without a critical eye to, you know, what's happening and making sure that you really understand the implications of what you're doing, and that you're really prepared from a data and analytics maturity standpoint and an organizational, you know, culture standpoint, that you're actually ready to embrace this. Otherwise, the whole thing could really blow up.
So not going too fast, right? So, but obviously not going too slow, right? To just kind of close the circle on that COVID piece. I think the way you articulate, which I agree, you know, moving to the cloud, more of like an infrastructure question, you know, I'm sure for a lot of leaders at the time was a question of just dollars and cents, right? Like, is it make sense for us to have data center? And some of the benefit, like long-term benefit, more strategic benefit, were on the fuzzy line, or like there's some assumptions around it and so on. And I do think that there was a very clear moment after COVID, and to play devil advocate, it didn't take too long to kind of catch up. But there was a moment in where you kind of felt it, where organizations, sometimes industries that were prime to work in that environment, that they, you were able to connect to a VPN from anywhere and be part of the, you know, be part of the network. And you had personal computers that the job, that the work provided you. And you had, you know, you, the disruption to business was far lower than industries, like you said, whether it's small business, obviously that's a bigger issue, but like, you know, maybe insurance companies, maybe like folks that weren't as prepared for that because they were more traditional, and likely because they were afraid of the risks that comes with putting the data somewhere and letting people take it home with them and so on, was really hurt. You know, again, I don't want to dwell on the COVID because there was a lot of other things that happened there that were involved politics that sometimes distorted the picture, where in the reality of AI, it's really interesting to see where it will go. Because I agree with you, going too fast, being reckless about it can have massive implications. How would you rate that compared to sort of like waiting it out and then getting to a point that something happens, because something will happen that will eventually cause it to now be, from a social perspective or from a business, you know, realities, the market's perspective, where it's just unparalleled if you have it and if you're ready for it and if your workforce is literate about it and, you know, how to leverage it.
Yeah. I think you need to be able to do a lot simultaneously, right? I think you need to have your eyes and ears open. I think you should be playing, you know, tinkering with some of these different technologies, at least ones that people consider, you know, safe. Make sure you're set, you know, understand how to change your settings or whatever. So any AI literacy or readiness program needs to include, you know, responsible use. And then if you're thinking about building your own, you know, GPT or your own agent, assistant, et cetera, then you should really have a sense of, you know, where the data is coming in from. Make sure you're sort of locking down that instance and make sure you're not, you know, uploading and training it with proprietary information, right? So use sort of benign, you know, data and just to get comfortable with it, and then just do thorough testing. I mean, any, you know, software development team would tell you, you know, we're going to do, you know, all these testing. I don't know if they do all the testing phases that they used to do when I was involved in that, in terms of like user acceptance testing and functional verification testing and all these different phases. But as you go through your, you know, more agile testing phases with AI, it's usually referred to as evaluations. You do thorough evaluations, because part of the difference between AI and traditional software, I'm not the most technical person, so I'll explain this as best I can, but when you develop software, a user can only do so many things to it, right? There's buttons and there's toggles and there's dropdowns and whatever. There's only so much user behavior that you can actually map. When you have an open, you know, rich text field, or someone's like literally interacting with you, with the program or the application, just completely freeform, you have no idea what they're going to ask or what they're going to say. So you've got to be able to anticipate some of that. And so people do what's called red teaming, and they do all kinds of ways to sort of do like ethical sort of hacking to see what would happen if somebody tried to use this for a purpose that it wasn't designed for. And so we've seen, you know, a whole bunch of examples of that. But that's one of my big concerns right now, is everyone is selling you something, and they're just not all AI experts, and they're not all thinking about it through a responsible lens, where, you know, it's ethical, it's transparent, it's explainable. I mean, if you don't have any of those things, it's what we refer to as a black box kind of solution, where even the developers can't tell you how it's doing what it's doing. And that's a scary thought, right? And so I believe in all of those core principles. It's going to help us make better and more fair decisions, especially in the talent space where I hang out. And so there's a lot of differences with the way AI can be trained and developed. And so right now it's sort of this gold rush where everyone's trying to get their slice of the pie. But yeah, so it's messy out there, but I just think people need to do their due diligence, but also start to experiment. So you start to get comfortable and then, come together and share those learnings, but you should still have some type of, AI governance committee and AI ethics committee that really takes the cognitive diversity of an organization and says, these are, not only do we see the potential return on these potential investments, but we're moving forward in a safe way, because otherwise you're going to, inject more risk into the organization.
And I like it a lot. And I think it's a very simple, practical concept too, that you kind of walked around in this entire few parts of the conversation, which is, it's a different beast. It's not the same. It's not the same from like the input as you described it. It's also not the same from the output. You can ask it the same question 10 times. You'll get, maybe 6 different answers. Now, the answers might not be completely different, but they would be worded different. And they might have like subtext that is slightly different. And it might have focus that is slightly different. And the criteria of what is good, what is bad, what is successful, what is failure, what is accepted, what is not, is different. So I think that's a really good sage advice of how organizations need to look at it and have that expertise in-house, have the network of people thinking about it and designing it. Maybe to finish up, taking back to kind of where we started on your personal journey, like what is an advice you got early in your career, or things that kind of walked with you through all those different stages of your career, and you think worth paying forward?
Yeah, one of the pieces of advice, very simple and straightforward one that I got from an old CIO at IBM, who was fortunate to be a technical assistant to the CEO at one point. He said, "Know your business, don't just preside over it." And that has stuck with me for 20 something years, because maybe I relate to it so much because I've been a generalist my career, and I find new interesting things that I think I can take my transferable skills and my curiosity and go learn, a new domain. So I was always sort of moving around, and that just came natural to me. But I also felt like it was so logical, because if you make decisions without really understanding how different teams operate, the interconnectivity between those different lines of business and different departments, you run the risk of all kinds of problems. First of all, the whole sort of left hand, right hand sort of analogy, comes to mind. But also, some of the things that you could be doing might be counterproductive, or you're going to market with conflicting messaging, or you're just not aware. Just thinking about talent strategy, for example, you might not be aware of what people are capable of and how to facilitate internal mobility for some of your best people who are going to leave because they don't know where opportunity lies elsewhere in the organization. Or maybe somebody that you didn't think had domain expertise, actually in their prior life they were on that other team. Maybe they used to be an architect, maybe they used to be an engineer, whatever it is, and they're going to come in with a fresh pair of eyes and a fresh perspective. I'm a huge fan of collective intelligence because it aggregates the cognitive diversity of a lot of different perspectives to help you make better decisions. And I think that's ultimately what it's about. So anyway, so that piece of advice really stuck to me. Just know the business, know how different pieces, operate and come together for the collective good.
I love it. I think it can apply to business. It can apply to life too. Definitely needed in the warfare of information and like you said, AI that can spew nonsense. So knowing your business will help you also leverage that technology better. So I appreciate sure. You, man. This was a great conversation. If someone wants to continue nerd with you or work with you or learn more, where do you hang? Is it LinkedIn? Is it X?
Mostly LinkedIn these days. So just, I think I'm the only Bob Pulver, easy to find. And or you can go to elevateyouraiq.com. I'm on Substack, elevateyouraiq.substack.com. Podcast of the same name, Elevate Your AIQ on all the major audio platforms. So yeah, reach out whatever you prefer, and happy to help organizations big and small. So
awesome. Bob, that was a pleasure. Yeah, absolutely. That was my pleasure. Thank you so much. Thanks, everyone.
All right. Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of Modern Business Operations. You can see the show notes and all of the resources mentioned on today's episode at tonkin.com/MBOpod. Thank you for listening, and be sure to subscribe for updates on future episodes. And if you're interested in staying up to date on the latest in business operations technology, head over to tonkin.com.